Good morning, this is Brian Trumbo with your Week in Review for Saturday, March 12th. In the past 14 months, we have seen not only natural disasters of historic proportions, but the magnitude, the intensity of them, has been on a scale that I can't imagine our planet has seen before in recorded history. Not just one or two events, but about 10 of ridiculously devastating proportions. Earthquakes in Haiti, Chile, New Zealand, twice, and now Japan. Historic flooding in Australia, China, and Pakistan. A cyclone, Yasi, that was the largest and most intense to ever hit Australia after the flooding there. Catastrophic droughts in China and Russia. Again, we aren't talking weather events such as Europe's record cold December or the blizzards that struck the East Coast and Midwest of the United States this winter. What we've witnessed outside the U.S. are natural disasters of immense intensity that hundreds of years from now will be referred to by scientists with wonder. You also can't begin to try and explain it. And in terms of Friday's cataclysmic quake and tsunami in Japan, America must do everything it can to help our great ally, an ally that it goes without saying we need more than ever with the rise of China in that neighborhood and the ongoing threat from North Korea. Ironically, I was going to be reporting this week how distressing the situation was in Japan politically and how one American screwed up beyond belief. The government of Prime Minister Kan has been on the ropes as Japan faces another campaign donor scandal, a scandal that this week claimed the foreign minister. Kan was in danger of being just another failed leader when the earthquake hit. It is assumed now he will survive at least for the initial phases of the cleanup. Earlier, one of our diplomats, Kevin Mayer, called Okinawans, quote, masters of manipulation, and extortion. In a speech at an American university late last year that just came to light in the Kyoto News, Mayer told Kyoto the account was neither accurate nor complete, but the damage had been done. Mayer was fired, and Kurt Campbell, the Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia, had to apologize on behalf of his government. No doubt the U.S. military has had its issues on Okinawa, though you'll recall many of our wounds were self-inflicted, as in some high-profile sexual assault trials. The U.S. and Japan are in the midst of a sensitive negotiation to relocate a marine facility from one part of the island to another. Bottom line, the U.S. desperately needs to keep the presence here because we can't just keep overloading Guam and expect to be able to rush 50,000 troops into any emergency that may erupt in that area, such as a Chinese attack on Taiwan or a China-Japan conflict over oil and gas rights in the East China Sea. So this was the background before Friday's disaster. Now these same U.S. forces are being asked to aid our friends in their time of need. But we need Japan as much as they need us, even if a vast majority of Americans don't understand the geopolitics of the region that threaten to blow this decade wide open. Staying on the topic of hotspots, there's North Africa and the Middle East. The world is not black and white as much as some want to paint it as such. Particularly in this vast region, each nation is different. I told you exactly what would happen thus far in Libya and Saudi Arabia, and I see no reason to change my tune on either one. In the case of the former, we had further evidence this week that the rebel forces are weak and untrained, whereas Gaddafi has the equipment and disciplined elite fighting units that are also very well paid. It's why the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, who oversees 16 separate intel agencies, told Congress that Gaddafi's regime will prevail. In the case of the Saudis, King Abdullah initially offered $10 billion in social programs to keep the peace and then increased the package to $36 billion. So, when coupled with a massive police presence, the Saudis successfully stunted any thoughts of a day of rage among the countries disaffected. Of course, Mr. Clapper's remark was immediately knocked down by his bosses at the White House, a place that, were events not so serious, could be relabeled the comedy club because it's downright comical how there is zero uniformity in message these days regarding a part of the world that threatens to spin out of control far worse than what we've already seen. And this is one time, above all others, that the administration needs to be speaking with one voice and have one message. None of this we're in, we're out, we're in, we're out garbage. This doesn't mean U.S. ground forces need to go everywhere. We know the military is stretched as it is, and we also have to weigh whether country X or country Y are in our nation's vital interest. But by waffling all over the place, the message we've sent to the likes of both Saudi Arabia and Israel, for starters, is how can you trust the United States when they summarily dump an ally like Hosni Mubarak? Next week, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is going to the region and making a high-profile visit to Egypt, and Lord knows what's going to come out of her mouth and how quickly the White House will have to refute it. I would hope, for starters, that Clinton makes it clear that the Christian minority in Egypt, once again a victim of violent clashes in Cairo this week, needs to have its rights protected. There's no doubt Egypt is the key to peace in the region. If Egypt goes the way of Islamic extremism, such as with the Muslim Brotherhood, Israel will be basically encircled. Perversely, on Wall Street, stocks rallied Friday, even as the devastating news rolled in from Japan. While it's often futile to describe market action day to day, Friday was as much about lack of protest in Saudi Arabia, which allowed oil prices to move lower to the $100 level after trading much of the week in the 105 neighborhood, as anything else. But it's way too soon to give the all clear on issues at two of the nuclear plants in Japan, as I go to post are most disconcerting on a number of fronts. It's customary to say that natural disasters are stimulative to an economy because of the reconstruction efforts that follow, but there is also the sentiment element I spend so much time on, and these pictures are as bad as any. It's a good time to wait 24 hours. Here's what is factual, however. This week, Wednesday specifically, marked the 2-year anniversary off the 3909 market lows as measured by closing averages. For the 2-year, stocks advanced as follows: Dow Jones up 87%, S&P 500 up 95%, and NASDAQ up 117%. Gold, incidentally, was up 52%. Personally, in terms of my forecasting, I nailed 2009 in predicting the Dow Jones and S&P would finish up 20% that year and NASDAQ up 30%. NASDAQ did even better than that. You know, one of my three best moments, the others being my calls on the tech and real estate bubbles, was sticking to my guns March 2009 and staying bullish. But the past 14-plus months, I've been too negative in calling for down equity markets, though I have been projecting only minimal losses, because I've been waiting for geopolitical events to overwhelm sentiment and fundamentals that only now are beginning to manifest themselves. I certainly stick by my forecast that we finished 2011 down, as I just don't see a great economy in the second half of the year, and thus I feel expectations on the earnings front in particular too high. I grant you that today the market is not necessarily expensive, but it isn't cheap. And we all know that come June, the Federal Reserve is slated to pull the plug on QE2, which PIMCO's Bill Gross is calling D-Day for Treasuries when the support dries up. I, on the other hand, do not see a huge bond debacle yet. I believe that comes next year. For much of 2011, I just feel slower growth and no wage inflation will limit losses in Treasuries. For the record, I'll say the 10-year doesn't hit 4.50%. Now, this means if you were in a treasury bond fund of any significant duration, you'd lose a sizable amount of your net asset value, but not a total disaster as some are calling for. In this opinion, I side largely with BlackRock. On the inflation front, I've given my stance. We are seeing a commodities price spike. Yes, it will hurt emerging markets in particular. No, it will not cause panic in the streets of the U.S., and prices will come down. Early in the year, I made the bet that the broad-based CRB index of 19 commodities would finish 2011 below 333.90, which is where it was in early January. For simplicity's sake, I'll say it closes below 332.80, the year-end figure for 2010. It currently stands at 351.88, down from the previous week's 362.88. So we'll have some fun with numbers in this regard. We've already seen significant signs that some of the global harvest may not be as bad as once thought and that the inventory picture could improve. The USDA issued a more optimistic outlook this week, earlier in the year than I thought it would. And in China, where they've been dealing with the worst drought in 200 years in their key wheat-producing area, they've now had 2 weeks of rain and snow, and the winter wheat crop has been saved for at least 90% of the land, a huge positive. No doubt, though, there will be further spikes to come. I've just staked my claim as to where we finish up come New Year's. On the oil front, the United States previously received an infinitesimal percentage of its crude from Libya versus 9% of our imports coming from Saudi Arabia, 8.6% Nigeria, and 4.3% Algeria. Nigeria's constant issues, but somehow it gets here. By the way, as of this week, it's really only China and India that are still buying Libyan oil, but it's enough to pay Gaddafi $200 million a week from the large refinery he still controls, and he's threatening to retake other facilities. Lastly, Europe. Going back to last spring, I've nailed this topic, calling out the occasional European Union official who would step forward and give the all clear. Such foolishness has been disproved time and time again, and those who also still want to believe Europe's debt crisis isn't significant couldn't be more wrong. Yes, there will be good weeks, which means no news, and bad weeks, which means the truth. This past one was a bad week. Europe's day of reckoning is supposed to be in about 2 weeks when the final touches are placed on a revamped and reinvigorated bailout program for the likes of Greece, Ireland, and any other euro currency member state that stumbles on a path to fiscal redemption. But Moody's lowered Greece's debt rating again, talking about its inability to collect revenue and the increased risk of default and debt restructuring, while Ireland's new government pleaded for a reduced interest rate on its EU bailout funds, and suddenly German Chancellor Angela Merkel said, okay. Really? You'll actually lower our interest rate? I never thought you'd do such a thing. Yes, I will, but you have to raise your Europe low corporate tax rate of 12.5%, which gives you an advantage. Uh-oh, thought the Irish, we can't do that. Many corporations already told us they're pulling up stakes if the corporate tax rate goes higher. Meanwhile, the Spanish government said it had performed some renewed stress test on its key savings banks, Cajas, and that they needed $21 billion in new capital, private money, not government funding, and they needed to do so by September. Only one problem. Moody's and Fitch believe the needed amount of capital is closer to anywhere from $50 billion to as much as $150 billion. How can there be such a difference, sports fans? It's that old bugaboo, transparency, or lack thereof. This is the single major issue that continues to plague many European nations and their banks. Just what the heck is on the books when it comes to sovereign debt holdings? Everyone and their mother knows, for example, that the large German and French banks own a boatload of Spanish sovereign paper, and that if Spain ever defaulted and was forced to restructure that debt, the German and French banks would suffer massive losses. But no one knows the actual exposure virtually across the entire continent. For all of America's banking problems, and we still have some whoppers, our transparency is superior to the European variety. Our banks also don't hold a lot of European sovereign debt. Finally, two other issues. The split between North and South in Europe continues to widen. This week, the Finns were furious over the thought of lending the pigs, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Greece, and Spain, any further bailout money, Greece and Ireland being the only two formally receiving such aid thus far. A Finnish member of the European Parliament, Timo Soini, said this week, quote, "We have been doing our homework. We don't have a budget deficit. We have done quite well tackling unemployment. Now we must help those people who have lied. This is the suspicious mind up north because quite many people think the South is milking our cow." Financier George Soros weighed in. "The political conditions further down the road will be less favorable than today. The divergence between the surplus countries and the deficit countries is going to get wider." And then you have the immigration threat I've written so much about, now exacerbated by the turmoil in North Africa. Fears are spreading across much of Europe as the oppressed and criminals and or terrorists wash up on Italy's and Spain's shores. Unemployment is already high in Europe. A potential surge of hundreds of thousands simply can't be absorbed, and will do a number on social services. It's no wonder that anti-immigrant sentiment is soaring and misspells trouble. A year ago when I was in Paris, I saw how that city has changed in this regard. It is teeming with refugees. It's also why I'm going back end of April, because amidst the beauty, I know I'll feel an increased undercurrent of tension, and across Europe it's going to manifest itself in anti-government, anti-immigrant protest with Europe's growing far-right parties, such as France's National Front, grabbing the spotlight. It will be ugly. Stocks suffered their second decline in 3 weeks, with the Dow Jones losing 1% to 12,044. The S&P 500 declined 1.3%, and NASDAQ tumbled 2.5%. For most of the week, it was concerns over the Middle East and oil prices that dominated action, as well as further uncertainty in Europe. I have much, much more on North Africa and the Middle East on or in my Week in Review column. So go to stocksandnews.com www.thefreedomfighters.com. Have a great week. We wish our friends in Japan the very best and Godspeed.